From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for November 6, 2020. The election is over, and there's no Packer game this Sunday. So what are we going to talk about? Well, how about No Shavember? That's right, guys. I've stopped shaving for the month of November. It used to be a deer hunting thing, but today it's mostly an unattractive fashion statement, especially for women, unless, of course, they work in the circus. A Scottish doctor claims vaccines cause autism and chicken McNuggets can alleviate the symptoms. Really? And as Abraham Lincoln once said, you can't believe everything you read on the internet. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police this past week made one of the strangest busts I've ever heard of. They seized $150 million of pot, three kangaroos, two zebras, and a partridge in a pear tree. Okay, made up the partridge part. And our Florida story of the week, a bored Florida firefighter left quarantine to party with his friends and then infected 30 of them. Well, Typhoid Larry is now looking for a new job and 30 new friends. And finally, this is the 20th anniversary of people living in the International Space Station. So what do you buy an astronaut on his 20th anniversary? How about a ticket back to Earth? On the podcast today, we have Kyle Tedding, Dave Sandstrom, Joel Dreesing, and wrapping up the week, here's Bob Landis.
Well, thanks, Max. What a week it was. NASDAQ up a whopping 9% this week, tacking on 984 points. NASDAQ closed today at 11,895, up a stellar 33.5% year-to-date, including dividends. S&P stock composite 500, up 7.3% this week, tacking on 237 points. The S&P 500 closed at 3507. Broader markets now up 10.2% year-to-date, including dividends. Nice. Dow Jones Industrial Average added 6.9% this week, adding 1,821 points. Wow, nice week. We closed at the bell this afternoon in New York with the Dow finishing the week at 28,323. Year-to-date, Dow different than the broader markets, up just 1.1%. You know, Kyle, all I got to say is what a turnaround. Compared to the bloodbath that we've seen recently. And as you pointed out, just off air, we basically recovered from what we lost previously.
Yeah, you know, Bob, I think maybe that's the jumping off point today is that we had a terrible week last week. And, you know, we were, I think, rightfully flummoxed is maybe the word that I'm going with for the way that I felt at the end of last week. Because it didn't seem that the data last week was as bad as what the markets had made it out to be. Obviously, there was a lot of tension about what was going to happen this week, and certainly it was a long week. But nonetheless, to get a almost 7.5% rally in the S&P 500 this week on the heels of what had been the worst week since March, you know, again, going back to the start of the pandemic, and, you know, you're talking about a week that mirrored or rivaled, you know, the depths of early pandemic markets. I'm quite impressed with how well things have rallied. And it's not like we got a lot of clarity this week. We got a little bit of economic data that suggests that things are a little better than maybe what we thought. We got a little bit of earnings data that suggests that companies are a little better off than what we thought. But it's not great news. It's just that we continue to progress in the right direction. And so, you know, I think if nothing else, a good reminder for clients that even as things look as bad as they can possibly look, when you're talking about last week, there's still the potential for significant rallies.
Last week, the analysts pointed to a huge uptick in positive virus cases in the country. This week, we not only passed 100,000 daily cases for the first time in the United States. But today it jumped to 120 some odd thousand new positive tests, and the market just shrugged it off. So pretty hard to understand how it could be an overwhelming concern last week. And for this week, it's not even making the radar screen.
Well, and of course, I think we need to remember that that is ultimately the piece we should be caring most about right now, not only because of the human toll of the virus, but also because it's the thing that allows us eventually to recover. That doesn't happen until we can get the virus under control. And so, you know, I think as you look at those counts, as you look at the 120,000 cases reported in a single day, and that number is absolutely staggering, you go, okay, it puts us one day closer to a vaccine. It puts us one day closer to, you know, whatever end game there is for this virus, because, you know, that's not a piece of good news. That's not something that markets should be cheering. And yet here we are talking about, again, a week where the NASDAQ's up 9 and the S&P's up almost 7.5.
Dave, you and I spent most of the fall talking to clients. One of the most frequently asked questions, of course, that we all got was, hey, Bob, how is the election going to affect the markets? What should I do? So it's pretty impressive, in my opinion, to see the markets make such a rebound this week, and we still don't know the results.
Yeah, Bob, you know, you look back a couple weeks ago, and I think everybody out there, most pundits were talking about the greatest short-term risk to the markets was going to be a contested election. And I think there was a lot of people that were very, very concerned about that. And, you know, we don't know what the next couple weeks are going to bring here and what type of, you know, lawsuits are going to formulate and go through. And we still have some votes being tallied and a few states that are still hanging out there. But so far, so good. And I think if we can get to the backside of this election thing, that's going to take one of the bigger short-term concerns off the table. And then I suppose it's going to be all eyes on the virus. As you mentioned, just an amazing jump here this week. And the markets seem to shrug that off. But I would think that as we proceed into the winter here and we continue to see the case counts rising like this, it's going to point to greater likelihood of further shutdowns. And it's going to probably be more likely that we will see some increased volatility as that stuff starts to occur.
You know, Dave, for all of the volatility this year in the markets, the S&P now is coming very, very close to the average annual return on stocks. We're at 10.2% right now, year to date, as I mentioned, that of course includes dividends. So if you didn't pay attention to your account all year long and you opened up your statement and looked at it today, you'd say, okay, that's an average year for stocks. My bonds did better than average. But if you filled in the detail and all the problems this year, you wouldn't think the markets could go anywhere near close to the returns. And it underscores one of the most popular expressions on the street, you know, the market climbs a wall of worry. Here's the proof.
Yeah, and what's I think adds a even a little bit more interest to this is just the dispersion between value and growth. I mean, a topic I know that we've kind of beat to death, but what I find interesting is just the anecdotal evidence I get from clients, depending on what line of work they might be in and how it impacts their feelings about the economy and so forth. Anybody that's in, you know, things like construction and technology right now telling me how busy they are. Their companies are setting records for profit. And then if you got a client that's, you know, maybe in something like the real estate area or, you know, maybe in banking or something like that, when they look at their share prices going down, it's really kind of a story of the haves and the have-nots. And I would have to think that that type of a narrative is going to continue until we kind of change our ability to get out. But I think that those stories that we've seen with the success of the what's been driven by the stay-at-home orders is going to continue until I think we get to a vaccine or get to the other side of this pandemic.
Joel, let's bring you another show. We had a number of economic reports this week. Let's start with the Labor Department report.
Yeah, Bob, that's always a big one to look at, the monthly report from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And, you know, we found what we're seeing in a lot of economic indicators. We're continuing to make progress. We're continuing overall to recover, you know, from that big plunge into recession that we had back in the spring. but the progress is slowing. You take the number of jobs. We added, employers added 638,000 jobs in October. That was the sixth gain in a row, but it was the thinnest of those six gains. We're still missing 10.1 million jobs from where we left off in February. And if you dig down into that a little bit more, there might be some signs of some future sorts of concerns, but we're talking about, you know, settling the election and moving on from November 3rd and the results of that. One of the things that's on the table is stimulus packages and stimulus proposals. And one of the things that that Chairman Powell from the Federal Reserve Board mentioned this week is just that the stimulus back in the spring did so much to help our economy recover. And since then, that's all kind of petering out. One of the areas of concern is state governments. They don't get to bail themselves out like the federal government does. So there are more layoffs, there are more lost jobs on the state and local levels of government. And, you know, government doesn't employ a lot of people when all said and done, you know, in the total economy, but it's a sign of something that the politicians, I think, will have to concern themselves with going forward.
Joel, if you look at the Institute for Supply Management service sector, same theme here shows that the economy is slowing down here.
That's right. Yeah. So, you know, we had the Institute for Supply Management has two indexes, one on manufacturing, one on non-manufacturing. Non-manufacturing, of course, is a bigger part of our economy. And that looked weaker than the manufacturing one. The manufacturing one, reflects the global economy and what's going on as far as the rest of the world and you know, buying things made here in the United States. The non-manufacturing one is more the service sector. There actually were signs there that hiring is weakening in that sector. And again, that's what we're seeing even in the numbers from the Labor Department on the service sector and the loss of jobs or the weakness of jobs in that area.
Kyle, let's get back to you for a minute. You know, it's so important, in my opinion, to remind investors that the stock market is not the economy, and the importance of really understanding that the stock market responds to earnings more than anything, and secondly, responds to the level of interest rates. So now you have a stock market that's heading back to where it had been, and you look at the economy, kind of a mess right now. Hard to imagine that it's going to be anything other than a mess until the vaccine arrives. So why don't we give people a little refresher course on earnings and why that's what's the driver of stock prices longer term?
Yeah, I know. I think just as a really basic refresher on what it means to be a stock investor, you know, the whole reason you buy stocks is to participate in the profitability of a company, and that's earnings, right? That's the piece we care about. And the question, of course, is, you know, what am I paying for those earnings? And we've said for a long time that stocks are a little bit expensive, right? You've got to pay a little more than historically you've had to buy that share, whereas a few years ago it was a little bit cheaper. But now, you know, you're looking at that relative to where we expect earnings to be over the next year, 2 years, whatever that time frame is. And I think most importantly, we're exiting a period of time in which earnings have been as bad from a year-over-year perspective as we've seen in a decade. And so every week that goes by, we're adding $1, $2, $3 a share to the 12-month forward earnings forecast. You look, 2 weeks ago, we added $2 to that forecast. This week, we added another $1 to that forecast for a year out from now. Some of that is because the forecast itself is getting a little bit rosier, right? We now see a better chance that vaccination happens for COVID sometime in the second or third quarter of next year for the vast majority of the population. You look, though, at the other piece of the puzzle here, and that is that the more of those bad weeks we take off of the next year, and the more of the good weeks we add to the other side, the better that number starts to look, the easier it is then to say, yeah, we used to have to pay $22 for that share and for those earnings, and now we're paying 21 or 20. And as we look further and further into the future, and as we're able to erase some of those pretty rough weeks, pretty rough quarters of earnings off the books in terms of our forward forecast, all of a sudden stocks don't look quite so expensive anymore. And it's not because the share price dropped, it's simply because the earnings piece got a little more attractive. And so, you know, even looking out a year, 2 years, stocks still look a little bit expensive, but they don't look quite as expensive as you'd imagine. And of course, the other piece of this is, what are your alternatives? And so we've talked for a long time about, what do you do with safe money versus what do you do with stocks? Safe money is going to not earn all that much when you consider where interest rates are right now. And so even if we expect stock earnings or the returns on stocks to be a little bit less than what we've seen historically, it's still probably going to be better than what you can get from bonds. It still, as an investor, means that you don't abandon the plan. It just means that maybe you've got to be a little bit more cognizant of what risks you have. Maybe you spread that risk out a little bit. And it's why we have the conversations we have every week about correlation, about balance, about all the keys to how we do this.
Dave, I've had more conversations recently about the international markets. As we all know, growth stocks in the United States outperformed value stocks for the last 10 years. Dispersion was fairly extreme. Well, the same thing existed with U.S. stocks compared to international stocks, where U.S. stocks on average made a whole lot more money than international stocks the last 10 years. You know, I'm of the mind that I like to get bargains on what I buy. May stay a bargain, may become a better bargain, but I like to get a deal when I invest my money. And, you know, I look at the valuations for stocks overseas, and they're attractive. They're cheap for a reason, of course. But when I look at the real possibility that Washington could launch a pretty good sized stimulus program, makes it likely that the dollar could weaken. And if that's the case, that could help the environment overseas. Overseas economies do well with a weaker dollar for all sorts of reasons. What are you thinking about international these days, Dave?
Yeah, Bob, it's interesting because of the obvious headlines with the election and the entire pandemic. It seems like international stock investing and just international equities in general have been kind of off the radar here for a while. But as you've pointed out, you know, with the dollar strength that we've seen over the last many years, it's made it a little tougher to invest overseas. I think people need to remember that when you own a foreign company, you're making your profits in that local currency. And when the dollar has significant strength over those currencies, it's difficult to bring those earnings back to the United States without losing something in that translation. So you're right. If we see a much larger stimulus position here from the United States, especially when we're talking about numbers in the many trillions of dollars, we could see a continuation of that weakening trend we've seen with the dollar, which does open up the door, I think, for maybe placing some money overseas.
Kyle, what do you think?
You know, I'll just stress the key short term to non-US positioning is, you know, what direction is the dollar headed? It matters year to year. It matters, you know, for short time periods. Longer term, we tend to see those things even out. We tend to see the dollar be less, or the strength of the dollar relative to other currencies be less of an issue. And what's left is relative valuations and the benefits of correlation of going outside the U.S. And so, you know, I think we have this benefit right now of the dollar being as strong as it's been for so long that, yeah, we have an added benefit of tailwind, but we also have valuations working in our favor and the added benefit of, you know, assets that aren't correlated directly with U.S. stocks. And so I think, you know, for investors, remain focused in the U.S. because ultimately what happens here is what's most important to U.S. investors. And so you want exposure to pricing power in the U.S. That's ultimately inflation, right? If inflation goes up, U.S. companies should have the ability to raise prices and as a result, see their earnings rise. But the other piece of this is that, again, I think there's incredible opportunity outside the U.S. in the right amount to be able to take advantage of those valuation opportunities, the potential short-term tailwinds from the dollar, and can't stress enough the benefits of correlation.
Well, folks, that's the end of yet another Money Talk. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.